Well, good evening. We are in lesson three this evening. We are engaged in a study of Galatians, the fifth chapter, verses 19 through 23. This whole 13-lesson series will be concerning the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. We've just begun the series, hardly. We are talking tonight about the second group of sins of works of the flesh. We talked on Sunday about the first three words that are in chapter 5 and verse 19, sexual immorality, impurity, ESV version, and sensuality. And tonight, we're going to move on and talk about idolatry and sorcery. So somebody was saying I should have worn my pointed black hat tonight. Never thought about it. Obviously missed the cue, but at any rate, we'll try to stumble through the current class anyway. What we're going to do is what we've normally done, but before we get into our regular procedure here, I wanted to mention that on the back there, on the sanctified table, is a chart that you might find helpful. I mentioned it before, and I finally got it all squeezed onto one sheet. It is a list of both the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, and as they are translated in the ESV first, and then seven other versions that give translations of those same words. Some of the versions are very similar to the ESV translation. Some of them are strikingly different, and you may find that helpful. On the far right side of the chart are the Greek words that we'll be talking about as we look at these sins of the flesh in particular lessons. So this evening, as I said, we are talking about idolatry and sorcery. So let's talk first of all about idolatry and the words that are used there. This word is defined by most Greek lexicons in an etymological way, meaning that they've basically taken the constituent parts of the word, image or idol, and latreia, which is service or worship, and they've defined it, for instance, as the Logos Sense Lexicon does, the worship of a material representation of a deity. And that's what an idol is. It's a material representation of a deity supposedly behind or connected to that idol. And once again, I've got them in the wrong order. But let's go ahead and bring up the next one. Bedag says image worship. Uses the word idolatry. But vine is the one who shows you the constituent parts of this word, worship or service, that is devoted to an image or an idol. Heathen sacrifices were sacrificed to demons. Paul makes that point in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 19. He was talking to the Corinthian Christians, some of whom apparently thought that since an idol is nothing, in other words, there's no real God behind the idol, that they could essentially go into an idol's temple and eat the meats that were being sacrificed, the food that was being sacrificed to that false god. Paul says, no. Those idols are connected to demons. We're not going to get into that connection, but simply Paul makes that connection. And idolatry was rife in Gentile society. Whether you're talking about Roman society or Greek society, idolatry, the worship of false gods, was endemic to their culture, so that in many different ways, even economic ways, not just religious connections, but in economic ways, even in politics, idolatry was connected to daily life. And so idolatry would have been quite the challenge for Christians, in the sense that they needed to be careful that they weren't defiled by things that might seem rather normal to most people in society, and they're going to stand out because they won't worship these gods. I was talking just this last week in a Bible study with someone, and I was making the point that in the first century and even prior to that time, when some sort of calamity or problem, sickness, plague, fire, flood, when that happened in a community, guess who got blamed for it? Well, whoever the community thought was angering the gods who were supposedly the patrons or patronesses of that particular community. And Christians stand right out. So something bad happens in the community, sickness that spreads through the community. Well, the gods are angry with us. Why are they angry with us? Well, somebody has displeased them. Who would that be? It would be those Christians, because they won't worship our gods. They won't worship the gods who are responsible for the prosperity and the safety of our community. Wow. You want to be the bad guy? That was the way that it would happen. And so here's some definitions of idolatry. I would draw your attention to the last sentence in Vine's definition, because on Sunday I'm going to preach a sermon entitled In Bondage. And I want you to notice what Vine says about idolatry. He says, an idolater is a slave to the depraved ideas his idols represent. And he lists there, for instance, Titus 3 and verse 3. So we'll talk more about that on Sunday. But there are no translation differences of this word. Every version on that chart, and there are 8 versions altogether, including the ESV, every one of them translates the same way, idolatry. And some of the passages that employ that word, idolatry, 1 Corinthians 10, 14, Paul says, flee from idolatry. Idolatry was often connected with sexual immorality. We talked about porneia in the last class, sexual immorality. How would that be? Well, some gods or goddesses were associated with human fertility, with fertility of the fields. And when you're living in a culture that is closely connected to agriculture, an agrarian type culture, then those gods become very important. And to worship those gods often involved visiting their cultic priestesses or priests in some cases, and performing sexual acts with those people as a form of worship. You understand perhaps then why Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 says, listen, the body's not for fornication, porneia, fornication not for the body. The body is for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Some Corinthians may have been arguing, like the eating of meats, that in the same way they understood that those priestesses, those women who were basically giving themselves to others in sexual ways as a form of worship, that there was nothing behind that. They were worshiping, serving a God that doesn't exist. So it's really not idolatry for me to have sexual relations with this cultic priestess. No. Paul says that's fornication, and that's not the purpose of your body. So he says flee from fornication. In Colossians 3:5, there's an interesting comment here. Idolatry is listed only in a peripheral way. Paul writes to the Colossians, put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness. Then he says, which is idolatry. We're going to come back to this in one of our discussion questions, but keep in mind that Paul says covetousness is a form of idolatry. In 1 Peter 4 and verse 3, Peter writes, for the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. I was intrigued by that phrase, lawless idolatry. As opposed to what? Lawful idolatry? That seems kind of strange. So I started checking some other versions. Maybe you did as well. And what you'll find is that some of the major versions, some of them on the chart even, they will translate abominable idolatries or abominable idolatry. Quick note here, and Vine makes this observation. Barclay makes this observation that sometimes in the New Testament you'll see words that are in the plural, and then other translations have it in the singular. You check the Greek text, it is in the plural. And here's the distinction. When a word appears like idolatry, when it appears in the plural like idolatries, a lot of times what the writer, the inspired writer, seems to be saying is that this is a practice as opposed to just a single sin or just a reference to the sin in general. And so when it's plural, usually it's talking about the practice. When it's singular, it's a lot of times just talking specifically about a sin, but not making any indication of its frequency. So anyway, abominable idolatries in the King James Version. So you go to the Greek text, and abominable is translated from a word that literally means unlawful, without law, okay? And it emphasizes that somebody is rejecting law, divine law, when they are engaged in idolatry. Well, some other passages, 1 Corinthians 5, you may recall that when Paul gives his instructions about who members of the church should withdraw themselves from, he mentions idolaters there in verse 10. Now, this is not the same form of the word. It's a cognate. Now we're talking about idolaters, not idolatry, but you get some indication of the seriousness of the sin and its nature from these passages as well. 1 Corinthians 10:7, do not be idolaters, if some of them were, as it is written, people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Paul's referring to an Old Testament example of failure on Israel's part when they committed adultery or idolatry with the people, the women of Moab. Idolatry is a broad subject, is it not? Because it is a primary reason for the exile of both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. God's people always struggle with idolatry. But fortunately for us, we don't have to struggle with idolatry, right? Anybody here got an idol in their home? You set up, you know, an image of Baal? Well, I don't even know what Baal looked like. So we don't typically have images in our homes, right? Is idolatry a problem for Christians? We're going to come back to Colossians 3 and verse 5, Ralph?
I was just going to comment on when you mentioned that covetousness is idolatry. When I go to Matthew 22 about loving the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your mind, your soul, your strength, it's placing nothing above God.
Good. And I didn't bring up that passage when I answered one of the discussion questions, but let's remember Matthew 22 when Jesus is tempted about the greatest commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with everything that you are, Jesus says. So we'll come back to that. Another passage, Ephesians 5:5. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure or who is covetous, that is an idolater. So he describes the covetous man as an idolater. We wouldn't think of ourselves as idolaters because we're not worshiping idols. Be careful, because Ralph, I think, has helped us define what idolatry really is. And it's a broader definition than the lexicons will give you. All right. There are a couple of passages in Revelation 21. It's unclear sometimes whether idolatry or idolaters is being used here in a literal sense or in a figurative sense. I tend to think perhaps in a literal sense, but you see those passages in Revelation. The reason I say maybe metaphorical sense is that adulterers or fornicators is used in a metaphorical sense in the book of Revelation. Yes, Eric. Right. Right. God is not identified with any image in the Bible. So when we worship or make some sort of image of God that he didn't give us, then we're replacing him with something else. And that's, I think, the core idea behind idolatry. So good comment. Good comment. All right. Let's talk a little bit about sorcery. You look at the Greek word there, pharmakia, and immediately, what do you think of? Yeah, pharmacy, drugs. Yes, Alex.
I had a question about idolatry.
I'm sorry, we've moved on.
I know.
Go ahead.
It looks like the Greek word. Is it a transliteration, like baptism?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not, because latreia is a Greek word. Idolatry is not. You know, it doesn't correspond to the Greek letters that are in the original Greek word. Latreia means service or worship. It's a little more specific than what we would normally call worship. There's several words that talk about showing reverence. My mind's going blank. Sabaya is one of them. Latreia is one. Latreia often talks about someone who has the job of giving service, like the priests of the Old Testament, the priests in the temple. So the word is a little more specific, but it's not really a transliteration, to my knowledge. I didn't mean to skip over anybody. Did anybody else? I've been accused of not seeing hands and guilty as charged. So let's talk a little bit about sorcery as pharmakia. And that should give you a hint that this word primarily, or at least originally, signified the use of medicine, drugs, spells, then poisoning. That's interesting. And then finally, sorcery. Vine continues by saying, in sorcery, the use of drugs, whether simple or potent, was generally accompanied by incantations and appeals to occult powers, with the provision of various charms, amulets, etc., professedly designed to keep the applicant or patient from the attention and power of demons, but actually to impress the applicant with the mysterious resources and powers of the sorcerer. How many of you have seen sorcerers? Where?
Ecuador.
Yes, I figured as much. In Zimbabwe, this is still very much alive. There are witches, those who use spells and incantations. They'll cast spells on people. If you go to them and pay them, they'll cast a spell on whoever you want. I don't know if you have to pay more for, you know, really vicious spells, or there's a general category, or maybe some sort of a menu. I don't know. But Professor has written about that. In fact, he's been the object of some of those spells by people who opposed him. So this is real in some places, although we probably wouldn't relate very much to it. Bedag talks about it as magic, translates magic. Gives the definition of magic. And Lonida also does, to practice magic, to cast spells upon. So you're getting a feel for the idea behind sorcery. The only translation difference in the versions that I looked at, and they're on the chart, is the King James Version, which translates witchcraft. That's probably a fairly decent translation for this word, pharmakia. So here's Revelation 9:21, nor did they repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. And Revelation 18:23 also, all the nations were deceived by your sorcery, speaking of the corrupted city, holy city, Jerusalem. All right. There are some other passages in the New Testament that translate sorcerer or practiced sorcery, but it's a different word. And the Greek word is translated pretty consistently by the ESV as magic in those cases when you're dealing with a different word. Well, is all magic sorcery? Boy, got real quiet in here.
Probably not. If sorcery is associated with drugs, I would think there'd be a separation.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead. The pharmacist among us wants to know if drugs are magic or sorcery. Yeah. No, we're talking about a particular use of drugs, and we're talking about a particular kind of magic. Sorcery, and this is the point I really want to make, sorcery seems to be connected to the occult, to occult practices, to demons or spirits, evil spirits, or powerful supernatural beings. Magic is sometimes nothing more than sleight of hand. You've all probably seen magic shows, perhaps, where someone producing rabbits out of a hat. There's no sorcery there, or at least most of the time it isn't. It's just a matter of someone using sleight of hand and distraction to wow people, but there's no, seems to me, no connection with any kind of supernatural beings or the occult world. Yes?
So then the sorcerers or the wise men in Egypt, with Pharaoh, they would be doing magic, not sorcery?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The magicians, as the ESV calls them, in Exodus 7, when they are replicating, supposedly, the miracles of the plagues, those would be called sorcerers. In fact, the ESV uses both words to describe those individuals. We'll see some passages, at least I hope I've got them up here. I think in the question section, I've got some passages from Exodus 7, a couple there, where magicians and sorcerers seem to refer to the same person. So, were they doing things that were tricks? Yeah, I would say probably so. I don't think they were doing obvious miracles or evidently miracles. But the question is what they were doing. Was it associated with some sort of occult practice or false god or spirit or being, supernatural being behind these things? Yes. And that, I think, is the constituent element, the important element, critical element of sorcery. Does everybody understand that? Am I making it clear as mud? Poof, y'all understand now. Okay, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. All right, so some other passages that actually use the word to talk about those people involved in sorcery. Again, you're looking at passages in Revelation. So let's talk a little bit about some illustrations. What we're trying to do in this study is we want to make sure we understand what these works of the flesh are. You really can't defeat an enemy if you don't understand who the enemy is. So we want to make sure that we understand what these sins are so that we can develop strategies, tactics for protecting ourselves, avoiding these sins of the flesh. Because what does Paul write in Galatians 5:21 about the works of the flesh? Anyone who commits these things cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. It'll keep you out of heaven. So we want to make sure that we're not involving ourselves in any of these things. Martin Luther made an interesting comment. He said, whatever your heart clings to and confides in, that is really your God. I think that's a pretty perceptive comment. God should occupy, he demands, first place in our lives, right? That's the point of Matthew 22, the greatest commandment, as it's discussed by Jesus. You love God with everything that you are. Nothing else, no one else, comes before God. In fact, in Luke 14, actually I think it's Luke 12, Jesus says, if you love father or mother, brother or sister, even your immediate family, if you love them more than me, what? You're not worthy of me. You cannot be my disciple. It's all, or you're out of the game, so to speak, the disciple game. Does that make sense to everybody? Well, let's look at some examples here. Do you remember the story of Saul, King Saul, toward the end of his, well, really close to the end of his reign? He dies the next day. In 1 Samuel 28, you remember how he is wanting to consult with God? He's under pressure. The Philistines are gathered. They're going to attack Israel. Saul's men are leaving, and he wants to consult with the Lord, but the Lord's not answering him. Samuel's already dead, so Saul wants to consult a medium. Some versions, the King James Version, I believe it is, will say witch, the witch at Endor. Something interesting about that passage, if you've got your Bible open, take a look, if you will, at 1 Samuel 28. Hadn't intended to do this, but we'll go ahead and do it. Look at verse 6. There were ways that the Lord would occasionally communicate with people that were set up. Prophets, obviously, was one of those ways. And when Saul, verse 6, inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. And Saul said to his servants, seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. Saul was looking for a woman who wasn't large or small. She was medium, right? What's a medium?
Size 4.
I'm going to smack you. Size 4, he says. Does anybody have a better definition? Yeah, Vicky? Okay, good. Medium is someone who's an intermediary between the living and the dead. Typically, mediums are going to be consulting with or have some communication with the dead. Thank you, Vicky. So Saul wants to his servants to find this a woman who's a medium. And his servants said to him, behold, there's a medium at Endor. What is interesting about that basic statement? Good, Robert. There's not supposed to be any in Israel. In fact, Saul had already tried to eliminate the mediums and the necromancers of the land. This is down in verse 9. Once Saul comes to the woman and he says to her, divine for me by a spirit and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you. And the woman said to him, surely you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the necromancers from the land. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death? Is this a sting operation, is what she's saying? That's the New Living Translation. Are you trying to trap me? Because Saul, King Saul, he's cut off the mediums. But when Saul says, find me a medium, the servants, know exactly where to find one. She's still there, and they know where she is. Well, that's an interesting story. Saul has disguised himself. He and two men go, they see this woman, and Saul says, "Don't worry, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." Verse 10. Then the woman said, verse 11, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" He said, "Bring up Samuel for me." When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." King said to her, "Do not be afraid. What do you see?" "I see," the ESV says, "a god." It's a generic word for a powerful one or a great one, coming up out of the earth. He said to her, "What is his appearance?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he's wrapped in a robe." And Saul knew it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and paid homage. So she, with whatever incantation she normally would have used probably, she's calling for Samuel. You think she really expected Samuel to show up? She does seem surprised, doesn't she, when Samuel does show up, which might indicate that she really wasn't expecting that. But she's making this claim that she's in contact with the spirit world and she can call somebody up for the purpose of consulting with that individual. So that would be sorcery, right? She's a person who is trying to use powers, or at least giving the impression that she has power to contact the spirit world for the purpose of information. Comments or questions about this story? Anything that you wanted to bring up? Or yes, Zachary. Zachary, before you start, make this an easy question or at least a comment.
It's one of the interesting stories, like where Moses struck the rock, the speaking of God, for whatever reason, allows his power to be used.
Right.
Like fighting someone sinning.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting. In case you can't hear, the air conditioning sometimes makes it hard to hear on the other side. Zachary's saying, similar to when Moses struck the rock when God said, "Speak to it," but God brought water out of the rock anyway, despite Moses' sin. So here's a woman who's doing what God has said is abominable. And yet, obviously, by the power of God, Samuel is able to deliver this message to Saul, which I think is the point. God's determination is to communicate with Saul. And so he does so now through this method. Boy, there's a number of examples I can think of. We don't have time to talk about them, but there are a number of examples where God used even the wickedness of people to accomplish his purpose. We talked about one of them this last Sunday evening when we talked about Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers. I think that was similar. That was part of God's way of getting Israel into Egypt. Yes, Neil.
I was just going to say that I'm not saying this is the Lord's purpose in it, but he also may have ended up scared her to death and not doing that anymore. She was so terrified when she actually saw Samuel.
When you said scaring her to death, were you talking literally? Because that was the penalty for this kind of occult practice. I think you were using an expression, but yeah, maybe so. If she wasn't scared to death, every time in the future, she's going to wonder, you know. All right, so let's take a look at another passage. This is in Acts 19, the New Testament. And so let's go over there. You can see, in fact, I've got a couple of verses up there, and then I've got you the text for that. But I'd like to go to the passage there and look at the context. So here's verse 11 of Acts 19. "And God was doing extraordinary miracles by the hands of Paul, so that even handkerchiefs or aprons that had touched his skin were carried away to the sick, and their diseases left them, and the evil spirits came out of them. Then some of the itinerant Jewish exorcists undertook to invoke the name of the Lord Jesus over those who had evil spirits, saying, 'I adjure you by the Jesus whom Paul preaches.'" Wow. It's all in the, you know, the ritual. Seven sons of a Jewish high priest named Sceva were doing this, but the evil spirit answered them, Jesus I know, and Paul I recognize, but who are you? And the man in whom was the Holy Spirit, the evil spirit, leaped on them, mastered all of them, and overpowered them so that they fled out of that house naked and wounded. And this became known to all the residents of Ephesus, both Jews and Greeks, and fear fell upon them all, and the name of the Lord Jesus was extolled. Now, we read that because what happens next among the Christians. Also, many of those who were now believers came confessing and divulging their practices. And a number of those who had practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted the value of them and found it to come to 50,000 pieces of silver. We're not talking about pagan people in the city of Ephesus. We're talking about Christians here. And when they see what has happened with this man that had the seven spirits, they come with their books that they were using, apparently, for occultic practices. Now, hopefully you notice that they didn't sell them. It was worth 50,000 pieces of silver. And I've heard of individuals who say, you know what, I shouldn't be doing this. And then they'll sell whatever it was they were using to commit sin to somebody else. I believe that's called a stumbling block in the technical language of the New Testament. But what they do is they destroy these books. I just find it interesting that those books were even possessed by these people still. So here are people who become Christians that haven't really made a complete break with the world, have they? It's a good thing we don't have that problem, right? We never carry over in our spiritual lives things that maybe we did before we became Christians. I saw a hand over here.
I was just going to say, they were probably former pagans.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Former pagans who held on to their stuff. All right, so let's talk about these questions. How did the Old Testament prophets illustrate the foolishness of worshiping idols? And I gave you a couple passages there. You probably could have found them yourself, but just for the sake of ease. And in those passages, what do the prophets say about the foolishness of idols? 1 point. Begin us. Start us with 1 point.
They can't hear.
They can't hear. Not only can they not hear, they can't speak.
They can't even stand up without being supported well so they don't fall over.
They have to be fastened up, otherwise they fall over like Dagon in the Philistine temple back in the days of Eli. What else?
They can't do harm, they can't do good.
Yeah, that's in Jeremiah 10. They can do no evil. They can do no good. They are powerless, right? Yeah. Eric?
And you made it yourself.
Yeah. They're the work of men. They're the work of men. In fact, here's my answer, at least in part. Jeremiah 10, verses 3 through 4, the idols are the work of men. He says, for the customs of the people are vanity. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked with an axe by the hands of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails so that it cannot move. Vicky's comment, they set it up. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish and gold from Uphaz. They are the work of the craftsman and of the hands of the goldsmith. Their clothing is violet and purple. They are all the work of skilled men. So you make this idol, which represents the God that you worship. But you have to make the idol. You're superior to the idol. And that's the point that Jeremiah makes. And it's the point that Isaiah will make as well. They're unable to do anything, as someone mentioned, Alex. They are powerless. By contrast, the prophets will point out that God is the one who created the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. I want you to look at this particular passage here in Jeremiah 10. We're going to start in verse 5. Jeremiah 10, and take a look at verse 5. It's up on the screen, but I wanted to read a little bit more like this. In verse 5, the first strophe, the first line there, is very different from the New King James Version. Verse 5 says, their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. Well, that's vivid. What does a scarecrow do?
Attracts birds.
Okay. A scarecrow is supposed to scare something, but what does a scarecrow do? Nothing. He just stands there. He's motionless. Can't say anything, can't move, can't do anything. They have to be, and they cannot speak. They have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good. Then in verses 14 and 15, I'm sorry, let's go back. I wanted to go to verse 6. There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For this is your due. For among all the wise ones of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like you. They, these elders, idols, they are both stupid and foolish. An instruction of idols is but wood. The New King James Version says, a wooden idol is a worthless doctrine, I believe is the translation. He goes on to say, they're made by men in verse 9, but the Lord is the true God. He is the living God, as opposed to the idols, which are not living, and the everlasting King, as at His wrath, the earth quakes, and the nations cannot endure His indignation. Thus shall you say to them, the gods who did not make the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens. It is He who made the earth by His power, who established the world by His wisdom, and by His understanding stretched out the heavens. When He utters His voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and He makes the mist rise from the ends of the earth. He goes on, God is active. God is alive. What about the idols? They can't do anything. Not good, not evil. They can't speak. They can't move. They're just the product of the work of men. Now, if you want something really amusing, read Isaiah 54. If you didn't have a chance to do that before the class, look at verses 9 through 20. Oh, it's a hoot. Here's someone who cuts down a tree and he burns half of it and, you know, makes his dinner. And then he takes the other half of this tree that he has cut down and turns it into an idol that he worships, falls down before it. Talk about foolishness. Okay, second question. What did Paul write in Romans 1 about the development of idolatry? Where did man start? Yes, Vicki. Okay, good. Look at verse 19 of chapter 1. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. He talks in verse 20 there about the fact that God has left evidence of Himself in the natural world. But then in verse 21, so they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. So they rejected God, despite the fact that He'd given them evidence of His existence. And instead, what do they do? There's a similarity between verse 23 and 25. There's a repetition there. It's not exactly the same, but there's an exchange in both verses. Verse 23, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God who cannot die for images resembling what? Mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So instead of worshiping the God who cannot die, who's eternal, they're worshiping the creatures who all die. Verse 25, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And you'll find in the prophets that idolatry is frequently talked about as futility or vanity or the lie. Why do you think it's called the lie? If you fall down to worship an object that can do you neither good nor evil, that can't do anything, that has not created anything, are you not being deceived if you think that that idol represents a God who can help you? Yeah, okay. Paul also, incidentally, in Romans 1, talks about the consequences He singles out gross sexual immorality there, but there are a number of sins listed at the end of the chapter. That's the consequence of people giving up or rejecting God and instead worshiping the lie. What did Paul say was the equivalent of idolatry? Covetousness. How does the apostle's comment relate to the definitions of idolatry given by lexicons? Remember what they were? In fact, I think I've reproduced them here. There are the two passages that talk about covetousness as being idolatry. The covetous individual is an idolater, Ephesians 5:5. Here are the definitions. Image worship, idolatry. That's BDAD. So you're not an idolater as long as you don't worship an image, right? That's a rather specific definition of idolatry. Paul is using the concept of idolatry, the core problem with idolatry, and saying that's the same problem with covetousness, is that something has become more important than God. The covetous man relies on his things. Covetousness obviously can relate to more than just things. People can covet other people. But the covetous man who wants to keep his things, who depends on, trusts in his things, what is he? He's someone who's worshiping something other than the Almighty God. And so Paul says that idolatry can be used in a metaphorical way to speak of worship to anyone or anything other than the true God. Martin Luther said what? What your heart clings to and confides in. You think people cling to and confide in their riches? That's the covetous man. What's the problem with that? Good. You're back in the Proverbs, aren't you? It's a lie. It's a lie. You can't depend on it. What does the proverb say? Wealth has wings and it flies away. You can't keep it. Often it's gone. All right. Well, thanks for the good comments. It would be a miracle if we got through all of these questions, all the things that I've prepared. If you're ever interested in getting the entire notes so that you can look at them at your leisure, you're welcome to do that. Just simply email me. I'll send it back to you along with a small invoice. Just kidding. Just kidding. But I will make it available to you. Don't forget the chart at the back. It's in color, so you'll want it. Yeah. I may have to try to figure out how to get some of this back into the class. I don't know if it'll work. Think of something. Try to do something.
The Lord is going to raise up from the dead. Of course, that wasn't easy.
That was passage was on this next question. Yeah. Deuteronomy 18. Don't recall the verses either. It's in the 20s. Leviticus 17, 6. The same thing. Don't mess with the necromancers. Yeah, very. You're safe. There might be some people who would appreciate that. No doubt. Yes, yes, it is. Oh, Hey, Mike.
Hey.
How are you? Thank you. Thank you. All doing pretty good? When's the next travel? Headed any place?
Well, a plan was just ended. In contention with the hospital.
That is our fault. Let me tell you what happened. I don't know that this was said in the last congregation meeting, should have been, but we hadn't had gospel meetings for a number of years. We have two a year for quite a while, and they weren't being attended. And so we thought, you know, there's a lot of preparation going into this, and people just don't, they seem disinterested. There's no point in spending the money to do that. Well, we got a request from one of the members here who said, hey, why don't you guys do gospel meetings? And so we thought, you know what, it's been a while. Let's try. Let's go back. Maybe we need to pump it a little bit. But that was fairly recent. So the planning has not been very far ahead. So that's our fault. But hopefully, if we continue this, and I think we will, we'll start moving ahead and plan a little bit further.
Yeah,
good. Ellen's not she's rebuilding after all of the treatments. Yeah. That takes a lot out of you. It's not well, it's over and I'm done with it. Really? Oh yeah. Wow. Yeah. And it helps reduce the fluid a little bit. Has she linked that to something that she really enjoys? I don't know if she likes to read or watch a particular program or something.
Yeah. I cook her breakfast.
Yeah. You're a good husband. Keep that to yourself, okay?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.